Thank you so much for tuning into the Psychology Is podcast. I'm your host, Nick Fortino. And today I'm joined by TEDx speaker and father of four, Aaron Stark. Welcome to the podcast, Aaron.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. We were talking before we officially started here. And when I watched your video, I think it was a little bit under 14 million. But it has crossed the 14 million view threshold, which is incredible. And yeah. I think it speaks to how important your story is. So to introduce you a little bit more, you know, the TED talk is entitled, I believe, I Almost Became a School Shooter, right?
I was almost a school shooter.
I was almost a school shooter.
Excuse me.
So we are recording this, you know, only a couple of weeks after yet another, just, I was about to use a bunch of adjectives, but it's like, I feel like people are just getting sick of the adjectives. Horrific, tragic, unspeakable. There's just, it's like words are getting cheaper. They're falling farther short of the meaning to which they're attempting to capture when we're discussing just some of the most horrific suffering that people are inflicting upon each other with these mass shootings. And the fact that there's nobody who's safe from them, not mm-hmm. even our most precious members of society, children, is just, I think, deeply disturbing for people. I think it's a fact that people can only take in doses or might try to avoid altogether. And I feel like, you know, you are, of course, uniquely positioned to speak about this because you've been there. You've been in the depths of that suffering and had urges and thoughts of committing such a tragedy. So that's what I want to talk about with you today is just, you know, I want to give you the opportunity to tell your story on this platform. And then, you know, this is a psychology podcast. And I know you've been on Good Morning America. You've made rounds publicly and shared your story on different platforms. But I think that this will be unique because it's a psychology-based podcast, you know. So we're going to, there's nothing we won't explore. You know, you gave me full permission prior to us recording this to ask you literally anything. So I think that, you know, we really might actually, like, you are a key to understanding at least some of the psychology that we must understand if we're ever going to reduce the incidence of school shootings and mass shootings of any kind. So I'm going to just go ahead and hand you the mic, virtually speaking, and let you begin by telling your story wherever you think it starts.
Okay, well, I was raised in... My kids today say that my life is like a Stephen King movie, but the way that I describe it is that it was kind of split into two different kinds, where my birth, from birth to about 5 years old, my birth father was the most violent human I ever knew. He exposed me to some of the worst abuse possible, like sexual, physical, mental. I watched my mom get raped right in front of me, just massive abuse from birth to five. It was like living in the worst Stephen King movie you can imagine. And then she left him and she got with my stepdad and moved from Stephen King to Scarface. So it went from massive violence to crack cocaine and crime and running from the authorities and constantly moving from place to place. Very, very nomadic. Excuse me. I got something in my throat. Very, very nomadic, very, very unstable life. And I never lived in anywhere longer than 6 or 7 months. I never went to a school longer than 6 months. I never had a stable place that was my spot. And on top of that, I was fat. I was smelly. I was sensitive. I wrote poetry and read comic books. And that not only was not encouraged, but was actively ridiculed and discouraged, like in all ways in my life. I was the worthless one. I was the fat, smelly one. I was the one that had to be like, I was the burden. And that I internalized that growing up and started to, I started to hate myself so much that I wanted the world to agree with me. And I started to express that by becoming more and more toxic and getting more and more abrasive and more less palatable to anybody that would come up to me. I would, the older I got going into teenage years, I started to do things like figure out what would offend a person and then do that. Like it wasn't ideological. Like I didn't have, I wasn't against any particular thing except for normality. Because by that point, I had been the worthless one long enough to where if you're told you're worthless, if you're told you're nothing long enough, you will believe it. And then you're going to do everything you can to make everybody else agree with you. Mm. And that's exactly what I was doing when I was, and that was 9, 10, 11 years old. I was the dirty, smelly, fat kid. And it wasn't helped by the fact that I didn't have clean clothes because we moved all the time. And I was constantly at new schools getting bullied by new people every other month. And multiple times in my life, excuse me, multiple times in my life, I got, someone walked, jumped into my bedroom, threw a duffel bag at me at 3 o'clock in the morning saying, grab everything you have. We have 20 minutes to get out of here. And I just had to, the only thing I would ever really pick was comic books. I'd get all my comic books and take those. And then we would jump in the back of a pickup. Me and my brother would jump in the back of a pickup truck covered by a plastic tarp and we'd be off. And it was mostly between Colorado and Oregon we would bounce. And it was always from running from the cops or running from social workers or getting evicted. Or there was a lot of times where we had times in my life where we got evicted, but my mom and my stepdad were at the bar busy getting drunk while me and my brother, who were like 8 and 10 maybe, were at the house with the sheriff getting everything thrown out into the mud. But my parents were at the bar getting smashed and then come home and fight because their crack cocaine got taken and during the eviction. Like that was just a normal day for us. And so the older I got, the more I internalized that and externalized that. And it became where when I was like 13, 14 years old, I just started becoming the most toxic kid. I started like, it was like a shield. It was like a blanket that I would put around me that would keep 99% of everybody away. And 1 or 2% of the people would come up to me and would agree that with, like, they would see the pain that I was in because they're in the same thing. And so it was kind of like a bonding, but that was few and far between and never for long periods of time because I was so nomadic with my lifestyle. I didn't have any good friends except for when I was about 12 years old, I met my friend Mike. And Mike lived at the opposite end of a block that I did one time. And we met at a comic shop and we bonded over comic books and video games and conversation. And he lived the exact opposite life that I had. So he had a very stable life, very loving family. His parents still live in the same house to this day. He was very encouraged with all of his dreams. Like he ended up going to art college and getting, going, traveling around the country and doing all this fun stuff. And so he turned into my home base. So anywhere what I was, when we were moving from place to place, Mike never moved. And I memorized Mike's phone number. So whenever I was in Colorado, I could call Mike and be like, hey, I need someplace to get away from this chaos. And I'd go spend as much time with him as I could. But mind you, he was my best friend for years and never once came to my house, never once came and had dinner, never once came and spent the night, never did any of that. Because the one time he did come over, there was just massive fighting because they couldn't find their crack pipes. And that, the degradation at home and the lack of stability just continued to spiral and spiral. And I described my teenage years like, I was living a movie, like I was watching a movie that I wasn't part of. Like I was just the audience member watching a really crappy horror movie go by. And when I did engage, it was like a giant tsunami, just this crushing waves of depression and violence and aggression that would just wash over everything. And I had no control over it. I felt like I was living my entire life in the fight or flight phase. Like I was on that razor's edge at all times for years, where at any drop of the hat, my entire world would blow up. And I had to figure out how to solve it right then and there, or deal with the most extreme violence and the most extreme depravity, like right there immediately. And things like picking my drunk, naked mom up off the floor because she's too passed out drunk, but my dad had been fighting all night long. And then he took off, stole all the money, and just lots and lots of stuff like that. And when I was like 15 years old, 14, 15, I couldn't take it anymore. I ended up getting homeless. I left home, started living on the streets at people's houses. At the time I said they were friends. Now I don't say they were friends. Now those people were not friends. They were what I called disaster groupies. They were a bunch of kids who were also depressed without much guidance, but 99% of them had semi-normal home lives and were actually kind of living vicariously through my damage. Like they were kids on the edge that were pushing me further and further out, kind of to see how far I would go sometimes. Mm. Like, so when we would sit around and talk, and because there was about a year where I lived in this flop party house where it was just kids, because one of the kids' dads owned it, but he didn't live there. So it was like a bunch of 15 and 16 year olds living in this house. And during that time, instead of talking about football or girls or movies, things like that normal kids would talk about, we would talk about killing people. We would talk about, well, if you're going to kill 10 people, how would you do it? If you're going to murder a school, what would you do? And it was just kind of the fiction of the group. It was, like I said, it was a bunch of kids navigating depression without much guidance. Mm-hmm. And I started cutting myself when I was 15. And it was the only bit of normal that I could find in that ocean of chaos. Like, it gave me one thing I could control, one feeling that I had some kind of agency over, was the pain that I inflicted on myself. It was kind of a weird grounding in a way. Like, it gave me a sense of a floor. Hmm. And that started to escalate and escalate. And there were times where, like, my mom walked in, saw me cutting, and laughed. And I followed her down the stairs, and she was like, "Oh, you're just doing this for attention." I looked right at her and said, "I'm just doing this for attention." I started chopping at my arm, and just, those are the big scars that I still have on my arm that I showed on my TED talk. And that, I never got any medical attention. I literally chopped my arm up. Luckily didn't hit any massive, blood vessels, but massive cuts in my arm, wrapped it in a t-shirt, went upstairs and sat down and played video games. And that was the, I couldn't do that anymore. Like, home was like, instead of it being a home, it was more like, if I absolutely had nowhere else to be, I'd be there for a night and then have to leave again, because I just could not take the violence anymore. It was safer for me to be in a park, sleeping in a field. And so once the cutting and depression and the violence at home got really, really bad, and it finally ended up where I was in the shed behind Mike's house, because I that was the other spot where, if it got so bad at home where I couldn't be at home, and it got so bad everywhere else I had nowhere to be, or the weather was terrible, Mike's tool shed was like my last refuge. There was a big puffy gray recliner chair, and the roof for this little tiny shed was like these wood slats with gaps in it, so I could look up and see the stars and stuff at night. And he would occasionally sneak me down dinner, and I'd sit there and have dinner in his shed. And because I was sturdy and smelly, and I was a bad influence, his parents didn't want me around at the time, so I was cast out from there too. I was legitimately toxic. And that, I was cutting myself so bad. I apologize. I was cutting myself so bad that night that there was a pool of blood forming underneath me. It was like raining. It was 2 o'clock in the morning. And I'm like, if I don't do something, I'm going to die. And so I got up the next morning and I knocked on my friend's door and I asked his mom for a phone book and bus fare. And I called social services on myself, because a couple of times over the years, social services has attempted to intervene and they were one of the triggers for us running. Like, as soon as social services got around, we'd bounce. And so I set up a meeting with social services. I set up a meeting with social services later on that afternoon. It was like 5 o'clock in the afternoon for the meeting, because it was like two towns away and I had to take the bus. And by the time that I got there for the meeting, they had not only called me in, but they called my mom in. And they sat us down and they asked me what the problem was. And I produced a bloody razor blade. It was one of the square box cutter razor blades. And I threw it on the table and I said, "That's my problem. I feel like I'm at the bottom. I feel like I have nothing. I feel like I'm invisible." And I showed them my cuts and my scars. They got my mom, who is the most practiced liar I've ever known. They got her. They believed her. She got them to believe that I was just making it all up and I was just doing it for attention. And they sent me home with her. And we drove away. And as we got like two blocks from the place, she turned to me with this mean snarl on her face. And she said, "Next time you should do a better job and I'll buy you the razor blades." And I just, okay, I'm the dark one. You want to see the monster? I'm going to show you the monster now. And I just ran headlong into that dark. And for the next like 9 months, I went on what I call my scorched earth time, where every bit of positive in my world, I annihilated. If you were a friend of mine and you were positive in my life, I destroyed the relationship. If you were around me and they were positive, I broke it. I snuck into my family members' houses and I pretended to be nice, snuck into my family members' houses and got into their photo albums and burned every picture of me. I destroyed every picture of me I could find. And my brother found out what I was doing near the end of that, managed to save a couple. And my girlfriend at the time managed to save like two. So there's like four pictures of me in existence before the age of 16, because I physically piled them all up and burned the rest of them. And that, mind you, this was 90s, so pre-internet, so it was possible to actually get rid of your identity that way and just erase yourself. And so after months of that, I had lied to every friend I could. I had purposefully tried to make friends just to break the relationship. I had gotten into other people's relationships and caused those to break up. Like, I was trying to be as toxic as possible. I was trying to break the world around me. And at the end of that, I was all alone. And I was in the field behind Casa Bonita. And I had been there for a week or two. And I didn't have socks on. I hadn't changed my shoes in weeks. My feet were literally rotting off my body. I was surviving on free samples in Albertsons and stealing food out of dumpsters. I was sleeping in the field and it was starting to snow. And I was at the bottom. And I thought the last time I warned anybody was the most toxic and damaging time of my life. So I'm not going to warn anybody this time. So I know that across the street from North High, the school I was going to, there was at the time a building that just said mental health on the sign. I didn't know what it was for. But I knew, like I said, last time I called and warned him, and that was terrible. So I'm just going to show up. So I went to this place that said mental health and I asked to see somebody. And I did. I talked to this young woman. She was early 20s. And I don't really remember much of that conversation, because all I really remember was the last thing she said to me, which was that, "I'm sorry, there's nothing I can do. I can't help." And I walked out that door and my brain shattered. I literally felt my brain break like a mirror, just crack. And right after that, like immediately after, I found out what was underneath that hurricane and tsunami of depression, that at the bottom of it, it gets really quiet and it gets really still. Because when you don't have anything left to live for and you don't have anything left to lose, then you can do anything. And that's terrifying. And the plan immediately crystallized, that I knew what I was going to do. I'd already spitballed it out with my disaster groupie friends, that I had already planned out either the mall food court or the school food court. And it's important to point out that neither one of those places were what we call soft targets. Neither one were, both places had armed uniformed police officers stationed in the place at all times. The school had armed uniformed officers in it. And in the mall food court, there was a police station like four doors down from the food court. That was factored into the plan. It wasn't that I was planning on killing everybody and getting out. I was planning on taking as much people out with me as I could and dying by suicide by cop. And so I knew what I wanted to do. And I knew where to get a gun because this was mid-90s and gangs were still all over the place in Denver. And there was gangbangers that brought guns to the school and would flash them around all the time. And so I knew they had access to them. And so I went to one of the groups of gangbangers that knew me because I was living in the park. I was always at school because you had to go, you had to attend school, otherwise the truant officers would arrest you. So I was at the school building, but I was never actually in class. So like these people knew I wasn't a narc or anything. Obviously I was sleeping in the fields. And so I went, but they sold drugs to my family and bought drugs for my family. So they knew me. And so I went up to him like, "Hey, can you give me a gun? Hopefully one that shoots a lot of bullets." And the guy's like, "Yeah, sure. Give me 3 days or give me an ounce." And he's like, "Give me an ounce and I'll get you that." I'm like, "Okay." And so that was the easy part. Because at the time, an ounce of weed, this was marijuana. And this isn't today where an ounce of marijuana is $90 from a store. You can't just walk down the street and get it. Like I had, it was like a $300 thing back then. But that was really easy for me because it actually wasn't that. I had to walk into my mom's house and steal it from a sleeping druggie sleeping on her floor. It was my brother's friend. I just walked in, took it out of his pocket, took it down to the guy. I'm like, "Here you go." And he's like, "Okay, give me 3 days. I'll get you a gun." I'm like, "Okay." And so I was set. And the instant I got the weapon, the attack would have been carried out. I wouldn't have waited at all. The only difference between the two targets would have been the time of day. So if I got it early enough for the school, it would have been the school. If I would have got it late enough, later in the day, it would have been the mall. And it's important to point out that the goal of the attack wasn't the people. It wasn't attacking the people. It was trying to cause as much damage as I could to make my parents deal with making a monster. My parents were the actual targets, but I didn't want to attack them physically. I wanted to have them live with dealing with making me. And so that during that time, during that 3 day time, I didn't know it then. I had no concept of what I was doing then, but looking back on it now, I think I was saying goodbye. I was going to people that I cared about and doing things like giving away my comic books and closing off relationships in like a peaceful way and like actually expressing deep sentimental feelings to people and like not the toxic aggressiveness that I had been in. And it was a definite shift. And I went to Mike's house and Mike didn't know what I was planning at all, but he knew the hell that I had been living in because it was in his shed and it was his mom I got the phone book from. And so he brought me inside and he would always tell me, he's like, "You're a good kid in a shit world." I don't know if I can cuss, but like he would just tell me that, like, "You're a good kid in a shit world." And that he was like, you're going to be okay. He sat me down. He gave me food. We watched a movie. He treated me like I was a regular person. And at the time I felt absolutely inhuman, absolutely non-human. I felt like I was just destruction. And he treated me like I was just a kid in pain. And it was the most cathartic thing that ever happened to me. And I never went and got the gun. I stayed at his house for a week and we hung out. And he's still my best friend to this day. And he is uncle to my kids. But it's important to note at this point in the story, though, that it's not like light switch flipped and everything was better. Mm-hmm. That caused a grounding. Like if you look at it like a parabola, like I was peaking with this insanity and this anger and this, all the tension was coming to a climax, and him doing that kind of like diffused and set me down on the ground for a while. And so I got really sad about everything I had intended, all that stuff. Like it started to really hit me. Like I got very introspective. And I never expressed it to anybody though about what I was planning, but I was very, it was I thought it was like a millstone around me, that it was just going to weigh me down forever. And then for the next like 9 months, up until like my 19th birthday, because we were at like 17, so about 2 years. Next like 2 years, to my 19th birthday, it was more descending back into depression. Not homicide at all. That had been completely diffused, but with Mike, but more self-loathing and self-depression, because the living situation was the same. My hell was still the same. I managed to occasionally get like a peaceful living situation for a while, like a roof from living at a friend's house and stuff. So that had temporarily increased, but that was still really hit and miss. And my home life, which was just like claws just latched into me with my mom and my family and everybody there, that was just so evilly chaotic and so violent on every level and just spinning out. Like every time I was around there, they were crawling through the carpet looking for crack rock. And just my mom stabbed my stepdad in the gut with the inside of a doorknob. Like if you ever take apart the doorknob, a doorknob on the door, the inside part of that, the gears part, don't ever stab somebody with that. That's a really bad weapon. So it was just like that kind of like outlandish, extreme violence and just disgusting addictions everywhere. And so the depression for me just was getting worse. So my coming up to my 19th birthday, I was planning on committing suicide. I had stolen a bunch of drugs from my mom, bunch of cocaine, a whole bunch of pills. I had gotten hold of a bunch of LSD. And my plan was to have a normal day and spend the day with Mike and act like nothing was happening, and then go to the field behind Casa Bonita and kill myself. And that was the plan. And I was purposefully acting during the day like nothing was happening, like nothing was wrong. Like I was trying to not act like any depression. I was trying to act as normal as possible because I didn't want another intervention. And then I went over to Mike's house, and because Mike was my best friend, and he was a very social person. Mike is a very social guy. So he has a friend group of his own. And he has in his friend group this girl, Amber. And we would occasionally go over to Amber's house and like watch a movie, listen to an album, do whatever. She was his friend. She was friendly with me. She was never like not mean to me at all, but she was definitely his friend. She was his contact. So we went over there because he's like, hey, we're going to go kick it at Amber's house today. I'm like, okay, cool. Thinking nothing of it. Think we're going to go watch a movie, you know. Then I was going to go back to my field and I was going to kill myself. And it wasn't that at all, actually. I got there and it was a surprise birthday party for me. And I walked into a bunch of friends and they made me a blueberry peach pie. And I walked right into the bathroom and dropped all my drugs in the toilet and flushed it. And that was the last time I ever tried to kill myself.
Gives me chills.
Yeah. And so now I try to help people realize that you have to give love to the people that you think deserve it the least, because that kid on the edge, if you just give them that bit of feeling human when they feel completely inhuman, can be the most life-changing thing they've ever had. A simple how are you doing can change someone's entire existence.
Oh my God, Aaron.
And there's a difference from that between the overbearing, what I call negative positivity, mm-hmm. where it's, oh, you're broken. Oh, we can get you into his program. Oh, we need to fix you. That is just as depersonalizing, or can be just as depersonalizing, as somebody who looks at you like a monster. If you're either to be feared or to be fixed, you're not a person. Mm-hmm. I was just a kid in pain. And being able to be seen as a kid in pain was the most important thing. And I really think that when I see, you mentioned earlier the Uvalde shooting. And to me, looking at that, that was, out of everything that's happened, that kid was the most similar to me that I've seen. His story, the way his story appears, looks like mine, just in different colors. He was raised by what appears to be a really aggressively abusive mom. He was raised by an abusive family that appears to be very good at hiding their aggression and their abuse, from what I've seen. And that he expressed that first in self-loathing and self-hatred, which then turned into him getting bullied because he was toxic, which then turned into him being the bully because he wanted to be more toxic. And that turned into him, like 2 weeks before the last shooting, or before the shooting at Uvalde, he showed up to the school with his face covered in razor marks, just sliced up. Both of his cheeks were sliced up. And that, to me, is the most outward expression. If you're slicing up your face, you want someone to see. And that I think that his slide that he was on was, and the reason why I think it was that way with the parents is because I watched an interview with, I think it was the aunt. I heard them say something like, "Oh, you don't know the hell he's been through." And I was like, "Oh my God, I've heard that from so many freaking people." That is exactly what my parents used to say all the time is, "Oh, you don't know what's going on. You don't know what's really happening in here. Well, freaking tell somebody." Like that to me was I heard it. I heard my family in those words. And it was, to me, what caused him, and I think, and I might be wrong, but I think what caused him to slide into the most evil possible was the escalation caused by, and I don't want to blame social media, but the escalation caused by social toxic subculture groups, where it used to be a phenomenon when I was in school, as bad as it was, when I would bounce from school to school and I had bullies, that I would have 10 bullies on one side and 5 kids on the other side that would kind of counterbalance. You know, I always have that kind of half and half where there'd always be more bullies because kids are monsters. But so there would always be, they just don't have the regulatory ability to regulate their emotions. So their emotions flow more freely from them. So that aggression is easier for kids. And so there was always more bullies than there was the counterbalance, but there was always that counterbalance. And I really fundamentally feel that we all at the end of the day want to be held and told that we're okay. And right now, if you go on in the internet, there is not only a group that'll tell you how to be the best bully, but give you tips on being a better bully, and then give you social rewards for being the best bully. So you're getting the social positive adulation and the positive reaffirmation that you've been craving, but you're getting it from the most toxic source possible, who is at the same time reaffirming that your identity as the most toxic thing, that's what you should be doing. That self-identity that you've adopted, that you should be the best monster. Yeah, that's what you should be doing. And all those other people, those are lying. And and here's why you should. And they have an entire subculture, and it's a giant social negative social network that they have that's like a mirror to the regular world. The Reddits and the 4chans and the message boards and the YouTube videos, that none of them are isolated islands. They're all interconnected. And they have their own social capital. And when people on the outside talk about how, well, the school shooters want fame, they don't want fame. I haven't seen a single one of them that wants to be famous. Not a single one of them that I've seen wants to be the person that they're talking about on TV or on the news. They want to be seen. They want someone to notice them. And the ones that are noticing them are the most toxic people possible. And so when he's sliding into that depression, he posted out right before that, "I'm going to go attack a school." It was the most blatant call for "look at me" ever. And nobody looked. And I'm not saying looking would have prevented it. I'm not blaming the people for not looking. I'm not saying that it's not like the ones, if you're sliding into that darkness, personal responsibility is a big key that you have to take accountability that that there is a line that you cross. Up until you pull that trigger, up until you cross that line, you're not a monster, you're a kid in pain. But you cross that line and there's accountability that then happens. Now you actually have the reality of it. Because again, you cannot fake your way through this crap. But yeah, sorry, I rambled a little bit about Uvalde.
No, I didn't hear any rambling. I just want to listen, you know, and I want to hear. Naturally, I don't expect you to be able to like diagnose every school shooter, every mass shooter, and figure out exactly the psychology behind that, because clearly there's some diversity when it comes to the backgrounds of these individuals and the profiles of these individuals. Yet at the same time, even though I know you don't have all the answers, I think you have insight, you know, having been there, So your views on the situation are extremely valuable. So please share them generously.
Thank you so much. I think that one of the problems that people looking from the outside in have is that they try to stereotype. We have two urges as regular people, where we want to be able to identify and compartmentalize the things that we look at, and then we want to make ourselves think that we did something to help. And the ways those manifest with this particular phenomenon is that people, they think that there is, oh, that's what a school shooter should be. And they think that the external is what they should be looking at. Like, oh, that's what they look like. That's the music they're listening to. This is the movies that they like. When it's not external, from what I've seen, it's internal. Whereas the difference of motivation is vastly different, and the difference of social status is vastly different, the sense of self-loathing and self-hatred in 99% of them, from what I've seen, is the same.
Mm-hmm.
With outliers being the Vegas shooting, which I have no clue.
Mm-hmm.
The Mandalay Bay, that's an outlier. I don't understand. He doesn't seem to fit any of the classifications or any of that.
Mm-hmm.
But we're humans, and we always have outliers. There's no rule that follows everything.
Right.
So. But when dealing with the particular adolescent or near adolescent males who, because let's just call it fact, it's the males who express their anger in such violent and evil ways, it appears that the one common thread is a sense of self-loathing and self-isolation. And it almost always slides down that similar path of, you hate yourself, you hate your existence, you are either abused or you abuse one or the other in early life, and you start to despise that. And that self-loathing then manifests as a toxicity as you're growing in your early age. And being toxic in your early age causes others to recoil and act violently and aggressively towards you. And so that you interpret as bullying, and it could be bullying. And then that metastasizes and grows to where you become the aggressor and you become the bully, and you want to externalize your own self-pain and make everybody else feel the way you do. Mm-hmm. And so that turns into the moving in from the bully to the bully, which is almost always the case. Almost always the case. I rarely see a bully who moves into the extreme violence that didn't start as being bullied.
Mm-hmm.
That seems to be a through line in most of it. I'd say 80% of the ones I've looked at, that seems to be the case. And then that then can metastasize further and kind of solidify into the hatred and want to destroy everything around you. And we all have our own individual lines for where that's crossed, but there seems to be a trigger line in most of that, where that line was crossed and something happened and now it's time to destroy.
Mm.
And almost always, again, none of this is absolute, but almost always there seems to be that last, I don't want to say cry for help, because that seems to trivialize it, but cry for attention. That last scream out to notice me, that they post a YouTube video or they post a blog post or they post a message board, or they filmed themselves, or they wrote a manifesto, that they're trying to express something that they feel somehow can only be expressed through extreme violence.
Hmm.
And I, listening to that is hard. Listening to people have those feelings is hard. People want to push away. People want to disengage when someone has those kinds of emotions. It's hard to deal with someone who's in that kind of dark. It's hard to be the mic. It's hard to be the island in the ocean of chaos, but it's the most necessary thing. And it's the one thing that I've seen personally disengage people who are on that edge is just being seen as a person. It's much more effective for someone to say, let's reverse it. It's much less effective for someone to say, okay, here's what you did wrong, and here's the three things you can do to fix it, and the five steps you can take to do it, than it is for someone to say, oh, you like that band? Oh, I like that band too. What do you want to watch? What do you want to have for dinner? Oh yeah. Oh, by the way, you probably shouldn't be so much of an asshole. That's, and you can see it because the toxic subgroups are using that technique. The ways that they're grabbing the people is that the normal world is looking at, oh, like you're a broken thing that needs to be fixed. And they're saying, oh no, you're good. You're good. All those guys, those are all lying. No, those are the normies. I see you, and they're all picking on you. And by the way, they all want to hate you. And it turned, when you feel seen, it can give you freedom. And we just got to make sure that freedom is positive and not negative. We need to push them away from those toxic subcultures, make them see that there's light at the end of it, that darkness and pain is temporary.
So in a sense, being seen and acknowledged by the right types of people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, themselves probably were, because it's like an emotional Peter principle. Have you ever heard of the Peter principle?
No.
The Peter principle is a thing in employment where you get promoted past the point of obsolescence. So you, let's say that you're working at a fryolator in a Wendy's, okay? And you're really good working the fryolator. And so the manager puts you on front counter. And you're okay doing front counter because you were really good doing the fryolator. So the manager makes you assistant manager. And you're kind of okay to be the assistant manager because you were good at the other two. So then the manager makes you the store manager. But now you're out of your depth because you were only good at the assistant manager part. But now you're in charge of hiring everybody else underneath you. Okay. And so that that's how the management ends up inept while the people underneath end up doing really well. Mm-hmm. And emotionally, we have that same kind of phenomenon when we're dealing with these toxic subcultures, where the people who don't understand how to deal with their depression and their aggression end up being the ones who funnel out the messaging, but then bring in everybody else because they also don't know how to deal with their aggression and depression. And then demonize the ones who do in the process. And things like the term virtue signal, which is itself a virtue signal, and then sends out that the demonization of positivity is then a good thing. Mm.
Very interesting. And I want to just highlight, you know, you just said a couple of minutes ago, that's the most important thing. So can you say again, in the same words or differently, what is the most important thing we can do to prevent people from committing these acts of violence?
Treat them like humans. Treat someone like a human when they don't even, treat someone like a person when they don't feel human. Give love to the ones who we feel deserve it the least. The we feel part is important. If we look at somebody and we see that that person is different than us, that that person is on the opposite spectrum, that they feel different than us, they think different than us, maybe we don't like their opinions, that's the person we should give more love to. That's the person we should embrace and bring into the fold. That Mike saved my life because he treated me like, instead of like I was a monster, like it was just a Tuesday. And we need to show these kids that it's just a Tuesday. Show them that the pain is in fact temporary, that the only constant in life is change. The only thing absolutely certain is that tomorrow is going to be different than today. It might be better, it might be worse, but it will be different. And so we have choices at that point. We can either refuse to adapt with the changes that come at us and get worn down like water on the beach and turn into sand, and all of our dreams turn into rubble alongside of us. Or we can adapt with those changes and become the water itself and move along the beach and travel and see the world and see what is out there. So if if you get stuck and you think that there is no movement, when you're in that dark, depressed spot, it can feel so isolating and so deeply penetratingly alone that you feel like there is no movement, that you feel like there isn't any way out. But I can tell you from experience that if you just keep moving, that there will in fact be change. If you move one step a day, even if you don't feel like you're going anywhere, even if you feel like you're walking on a treadmill, you move one step a day, wait 15 days and turn around. You've moved 15 steps. You just didn't see it because it was glacial. But when you look back, you have in fact have changed. You are different now than you were yesterday, and even more different than you were the day before. So be different again tomorrow.
Mm. And I also want to highlight what you said about how whether you're feared, whether you be, you whether you're seen as, you know, whether you're feared or you're seen as needing to be fixed.
Mm-hmm.
Either way, you're not being seen like a person.
Yep.
And I think that's insightful. That's really interesting to me. And I think you're spot on with that. I think when we look at people as though they need, they're broken and that they need to be fixed, like they're a project, that is dehumanizing, almost mm-hmm. in the same way as it's dehumanizing to see them as a monster and fear them.
Yep. And to the person in that dark, you will shut off any ability to actually help. Mm-hmm. As soon as you get into, anybody who deals with those people will know that one of the first things that a person in that depressed state will do, will they will test you. They'll push your limits right away to see whether or not you know what you're talking about and whether or not you can be offended, whether or not you can be pushed away. Are you like everybody else in the world? Are you like everybody else that doesn't listen, that doesn't know me? And do you actually see who I am? Because one of the important things about to realize about that self-loathing is when you internalize it so much, when you hate yourself so much that it's become your identity, anybody else that looks in and says, oh, you're really a good person, you obviously don't know me. You don't know who I am, because if you knew me, you would see the monster. So you have to figure out how to see and how to break through that. And the only way to do that is with normalcy, with reestablishing normal world. Because we have a couple universal truths about humanity that are completely mundane. And if we focus on those, then we can get back to mundane things and one of the problems with depression is that you get lost in, fanciful is the wrong word for it, but fictional in a way. You get lost in what your brain's telling yourself about things. And when you get reminded of, if you're sitting there thinking, oh, the entire world hates me, everybody that's around me hates me, everybody thinks I'm a monster, everybody thinks I'm disgusting, then you stop and just think for a second and you're like, well, every single person I met today also took a poop. Every single one of them. Like, it's completely mundane, but absolutely human and absolutely true. Every person, every politician, every movie star, everybody, we all went to the bathroom sometime today. It just happens. and being able to reestablish, and that's a comical way to put it in the colloquial sense, but to reestablish that sense of normal, that okay, I understand you're spinning out into depression. Now, what would you like to eat? What would you want to go take a shower? Bathing yourself is really important. And when you lose your sense of self, one of the first things that I've seen go is your sense of self-preservation as far as hygiene and as far as like the material self, because it's very much Maslow's hierarchy of needs, where if you don't have your initial needs met of survival, if I don't know that I'm able to survive the night, then I don't care whether or not I've bathed.
Right.
You know, like, and so what you have to establish the base needs to get to the higher up ones. But if you can kind of short circuit that and establish a couple higher up ones and remind that you have the base ones, then maybe you can see that the evolution of life that actually happens, because people lose sight of the fact that tomorrow is coming. And that to be able to reassess that can literally be life-saving.
Yeah, these feel like very kind of novel ideas in a sense, but also very sober ideas. I see what you mean about maybe some people's ideas about what it takes to overcome depression. Some people have lofty ideas about what that might look like. Very rarely do I hear people say, just aim for feeling normal. Like it's just a Tuesday. That idea, that's very intriguing to me. And
yeah, I think that that loftiness plays in with the urge, and the urge to make ourselves think that we fix things.
Yeah,
because we all want to help. We all want to help, and we all want to help in our different ways. And that's not a negative, to put it that way. People think that that's a derogatory term. That's not at all a derogatory term. We all want to put our effort in to things that we care about to make it help. But it expresses it in ways, and we see it in the most extreme ways with things like hardening the schools or arming the teachers. Things like that, which are pushing out that kid further into the dark. First off, right. Only thing you're doing is changing a plan. You're not changing a target. You're changing a plan.
Yeah.
That's if you limit it to one door, then you're just changing the plan of how to get the people out the one door. Like that's to me, that makes like, why didn't you think that logical step through? Mm-hmm. And but they come from a place of really caring. They come from a place of honest wanting to help. Like all these efforts that people have about trying to fix the schools and they come from a place of wanting to help. But the things that we all miss in that is the thing that we're trying to help is a kid screaming out in pain. That these measures that the adults argue about whether or not this school can be hardened, whether or not this safety measure is there, whether or not we need more gun control, whether or not the polar opposite messagings of gun control and mental health, I purposefully try to avoid except to make this point in every single conversation I have, which is that both of those arguments are diversionary and useless to the point that as soon as you mention either gun control or mental health, you've lost the focus on what it actually is you're dealing with. The gun control, you get lost in the minutiae of the detail. You get lost in, is that a bump stock? Is that ammunition? Is that an assault rifle? What's my Second Amendment right? And then you get lost in the actual detail of the fact that what you really want is you want to keep weapons that kill people out of the hands of people like I was when I was 15. You want to keep the kids who want to kill people from being able to kill people. That's what you want. You're not really worried about the 40-year-old hunter guy who owns a lot of guns because he's the one with all the licenses. He's not the one we're really worried about. We want to keep the hands out of the ones who are depressed and feel like they're going to destroy things. So why are they depressed and wanting to destroy things? And that's when you hit the things with mental health. Well, it's a mental health issue. Okay, well, what does that mean? Mental health is the gray, giant gray amorphous blob. It's a big gray cloud that no one else can wrap their hands around. It's terminology that no one actually can specify. And if you do specify to regular people, it tends to lose a specificity because they don't know what the heck you're talking about. Mm-hmm. And so you get completely lost into this gray haze of it. So that's why instead of talking about mental health, I say I was depressed and alone and felt worthless because I was pushed deeper and deeper into that depression. Put a face onto it, put a reality onto it, because this is a real thing. And I've noticed that we have, and I'm sure we all noticed, we have this gigantic split growing in society. This big break that seems to be happening. And the one thing that cuts through that breaks through all those barriers of different religions, different ethnicities, different social status, different political status, is that we all feel this sense of self-isolation and worthlessness. We all feel this sense of being alone. And it's sad that that's one of the things that one of the only universal things that binds us together, but it's true. And if that's one of the things that can bind us together, then maybe if we focus on that for a while, we can start bringing us together and stop spreading apart through xenophobia and fear of the other. And we can really show love to the ones that we each feel deserve it the least.
Beautifully said. Yeah. And I definitely agree with you that there are many examples of good intentions and bad strategies. And I feel like you are, you know, offering something very valuable to the people who have good intentions, because the people with good intentions, they obviously want to be able to manifest them and carry them out. And so they need good strategies. And so what I understand you to be saying is that the main strategy that we should adopt is to show love to the people who we feel deserve it the least. Mm-hmm. And understand that, you know, typically people who have the urge to destroy are feeling depressed and alone and worthless, and we have to show them love in a way that is also makes life feel a little bit more normal. Is that fair?
No one starts their life monsters. No one goes through life looking forward to the day where they can turn into a destructive demon. No one's doing that. It's not a goal that people have. It's the end that people have. And what was the start? And how did you travel? And what was the slide? Because there seems to be a consistent slide with these. There seems to be that, barring a few cases where it seems to be an aberration, there seems to be at least four, a large percentage of them. And that touches on another point. The fact that I always have to specify that if there's aberrations, people are constantly looking for a fix-all. They want to have a band-aid that's going to fix everything. This is not going to stop all school shootings. It might stop one. And right now, one has to be enough. That we have to make incremental movement somewhere. Because if we continually look for these fix-all things that one gun law is not going to stop all school shootings, so we can't pass that gun law, or that one law is not going to stop everybody from being depressed or hurting themselves, so we can't pass mm-hmm. that legislation, well, then we're not doing anything. Right. All we're doing is arguing and talking about talking. And anybody who's been through a business meeting where the entire business meeting, all you do is talk about the next business meeting, knows how absolutely pointless it is to continually talk about talking. Like, that's, we have to look past those and get to the reality of the situation, which is that we have a bunch of people in pain, and we have a bunch of people who are crying out for someone to notice them somehow. And a large portion are getting noticed by the worst people possible. And we can either ignore that and continually try to throw our band-aids on the situation and make ourselves feel good because we did something to make ourselves feel good, or we can do the hard thing and listen to pain. Might make us face our own pain. Might make us want to see what we're going through ourselves, which is the hardest part of it all. Because one of the things that is absolutely almost universal for people who listen to me and talk to me one-on-one is that after I tell them my story, they tell me theirs. And because we each go through this stuff, and it's hard to touch that pain. It's hard to realize that at one time you wanted to end it. It's hard to realize at one time you wanted to end it for someone else, or that fundamentally there's no difference in the pain that I was feeling in my most destructive and the pain that a model feels when she's throwing up in a cup outside her car, in her car before her photo shoot. There's no difference in that, because men and women internalize our pain differently. Men tend to get more aggressive and get violent, which is why I think those shootings are caused by men. Women internalize it more internally and more towards their self-depreciation, where there's a lot of eating disorders and a lot of beauty disorders and a lot of self-harm, because that's where they get directed. They have to hold up to their own standards of they have to be the beautiful one. So they have to make themselves the beautiful one. And to do that, they have to destroy themselves. Mm-hmm. And that's it. It's at the base of it, it looks vastly different. If you looked at me when I was 15 or 16, and you look at who's a famous one, Tyra Banks was, I believe, anorexic. I could be wrong. Apologies, Tyra, if I'm wrong, but I'm just going to use her as an example. Mm-hmm. Well, let's say Tyra Banks is as an anorexic model. Okay. Someone who had an eating disorder. A famous person with an eating disorder looks vastly different. Me, depths of depression living in a field. Okay. Them, celebrity living in a mansion. Both of us hate our existence and want to destroy our own selves.
Right.
And that it, we just need to start seeing that we're all people.
Yeah. Wow. If you could, let's imagine that someone saw this video or is listening to this audio, and they are maybe even have thought the thought, maybe I could go kill somebody. They are on a trajectory toward committing horrible violence. What would you say to this person?
To not give in to the pain, to keep walking. That the only constant in life is change. And that one day when they're out of this pain, because this pain is in fact temporary, that they will realize that they have survived each one of their worst days. All of their worst times, they've already survived. Mm. And if they keep on going and don't give up, they'll keep on surviving. Mm. But it's a choice to fall into the ultimate destruction. Mm. You have to choose not to.
Yes. The way that you speak about all this, there's something I really like about it, which, I mean, there's many things I like about it, but one of which is that you reserve moral accountability for both the individual and the individual's social environment. And I just think that that's important to assign responsibility to each, the group and the individual. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, I've just heard people talk in different ways where they seem to kind of pendulate toward one or the other of those. And that seems problematic to me because you can't necessarily assign all responsibility on the individual because the environment needs to step up and acknowledge them and show them love and meet their needs and provide a healthy environment. And yet you can't assign all responsibility onto the others as well either, because the individual does need to take some moral accountability here. And I can mm-hmm. I hear those, you know, notes in what you're saying, that there's responsibility for everybody, the perpetrator and the people in the perpetrator's lives. And the other thing I wanted to say too is, I always think it's really interesting to think about how it's impossible to really know what tragedy you prevented by connecting with somebody or by mm-hmm. you speaking out on a platform like this, or because sometimes there might be a case where someone thought, like in your case, you know, you were going to do that and you can pinpoint exactly what factor pulled you back from that edge, which was the way Mike treated you and connected with you. But mm-hmm. I would imagine that there are many other people who were in an incredible amount of pain, but they hadn't quite gotten to the point where the thought or the urge manifested, I'm going to go kill somebody, but they were on that trajectory. And then someone came in and pulled them back much sooner than when they got to that edge. So they never knew what they might have ever done. And mm-hmm. therefore no one will know where they could have gone and what horrific tragedy they could have inflicted on the world. So the point is that we can't know just how like positive the impact is. We can't know what exactly we've prevented. And I think there's something to say for just trusting that if you treat people like people and you connect in an authentic, compassionate, real, like totally non-condescending way, you're not trying to fix anybody, you're just connecting, then it's incalculable just how much damage you might have prevented.
Well, and the thing to remember that is, while we can't calculate how much damage has been prevented, we can calculate how much negativity has been caused, which is zero. The amount of negativity caused by human connection, by acknowledging someone's existence and by seeing them as a person, the amount of damage caused by that is zero. So the amount of positivity might vary, but the amount of damage doesn't vary. Right. And so that is an important thing to remember, that there is no cost to being nice. Mm. There is no cost to being kind. And that is a really hard thing to get across these days, because there's a lot of people out there pushing the exact opposite message. Mm. That niceness is a negative, that kindness is a detriment. That is my biggest opponent. That's the counter programming to what I talk about, is the ones who'd say that, yeah, you can be the best monster and that's what you should be. And that right there is, I think, this force that's trying to break us all apart. And we just have to, in my opinion, open up the gates of positivity in a way that where we can acknowledge and accept people. And it's important in that acceptance, like you said, to have that accountability, because it one of the most impactful ways to help somebody is to say, oh, is to do what I mentioned earlier. Be like, okay, you want to, let's watch a movie. Let's talk about this. How was your day? Oh, by the way, maybe you shouldn't be that toxic. Maybe if you weren't that toxic, we could go that other way and address the person as a person. That this is the reality of it, man. Like you're you're being a dick. Don't be a dick. Like you have to address the reality of the situation, because everybody else in their world doesn't. No one else in their world will. Most people in that depression are dealing with everybody looking at them like they're a monster or they're broken. And when people deal with you like that, then you don't trust anybody. Mm. And that we have to just get past that. And like you said, give love, bring in the ones in the darkness, show love to the ones who we feel deserve it the least.
And it's interesting to think about those people who we feel deserve it the least. And the question of who is most well positioned to show them love. And I suppose the short answer is everyone and anyone. Mm-hmm. But also, I understand how difficult it can be for a person who has been hurt by the person who is depressed. Like it would have been unrealistic, for example, for you to be expected to be the one to show love to your dad.
Well, and that's a great example, because right now, so my birth dad and my stepdad are both dead. My mom, however, is not, but she hasn't spoken to me in 4 years, ever since she came out with my story, except to attack me, because she's mad that I'm talking about family business out in public, which is why my response is, if you're upset about what happened, what me talking about the truth of what happened 30 years ago, but you're not acknowledging the man I am today, then the problem isn't my fault. Mm. And that I'll stop the instant you tell me one thing I'm saying that's not the truth. But that, so I accountability goes both ways. In order to be giving love, you have to be, if she ever had accountability, if she ever accepted what happened, if any of that, then I'd be able to possibly address that situation. But since there's not, then I have to look out for my own positivity, and I can't allow that toxicity to harm me. But I also had to address that with her. I had to tell her that. I had to be like, okay, you're toxic. I'm done with this. We're over. And I think that's an important line when dealing with people in this depression, because that's something that brings up all the time. How am I supposed to help this person if they're being toxic to me? They're the toxic one. Me helping them is harming me. And at that point, disengage. At that point, if they're harming you and they're toxic, disengage. Disengage to the point where you can remind them that, hey, I see you. You're a person, but you're messing up, and I'm going to be here if you stop messing up. But while you're messing up, I'm going to have to go away. And having be the island of normal. Normal is key. You mentioned that just a bit ago. That's something I talked about. It is being the island of normal in the ocean of chaos, because that person, it's the same way when we tell our kids, look, that bully is probably dealing with being bullied himself. When they're little, when we have to remember that up until we are about 15 years old, we don't have any agency over ourselves. Our parents control our lives. They control where we're living. They control where we're sleeping. They control where we're eating. They control all these things, but they don't control how we react to ourselves. So that's why we always tell our kids that you can't control what everybody else is doing. We can control how you respond to that. Okay. And when you're dealing with someone in that depression, it's kind of the same way. You can't control how they're feeling, but you can control how you respond. And if you respond with consistency and kindness, then you will win out. Whether you're firm or not, if you're firm and you say, I'm sorry, I can't deal with this right now. You're being too toxic. You need to go away. And then when that person comes back, when they're not toxic, then you don't hold the grudge. You see them as the person they are now, and you acknowledge, okay, that was bad, or you've moved on. Okay, now we've moved on. Now we can continue. Then you're going to be that island. My relationship with Mike hasn't always been sunshines and rainbows. There were times growing up where I pissed him off, and he had to pull me to account. Mm-hmm. And him pulling me to account and seeing me as a person, that was part of it. Right. Like, right. If everybody else is too afraid, everybody else is too scared to confront that kind of person, because what are they going to do? What are you going to do if they confront him? They're going to blow up? No, he's not going to blow up, because he respects me, because I respect him. I'm going to tell him how I feel. And having that, the respect on both sides to actually fully address the reality of the situation is very important.
Yeah.
That we can't live in sound bites and postcards. We can't live in bumper sticker slogans. Mm-hmm. This we the rest of our life is that. We all look at our phones and everything's a headline. everything's a meme, but emotions aren't a meme. And if you treat it like it is, then all you're going to do is push them further and further into that depression.
Mm.
And if you start seeing the signs of self-loathing and self-destruction, and that they do things like a complete change in diet, or they start to self-harm, or their personal hygiene drastically drops off, that things like that, those are warning signs. Those are signs that you should look and pay attention and engage and see the person as a person, because they're probably calling for someone to see them.
Yeah. And I think what you're saying is also important about both kindness and straightforwardness, being bluntly calling them out for the reality of what's happening. But I feel like there are people who sometimes only do one or the other, and they're kind in a way that's way too lenient almost. They're kind in a way, they're lenient in a way, they let their person get away with stuff in a way where if they really were seeing them like a person, they would not let them get away with that bullshit. But yeah. There's that camp. And then there's the camp of people who are just harsh, and all they do is call out the harsh reality of how bad you're fucking up. And mm-hmm. yet they're never kind about it. So to do both, to be kind, consistent, I love that too, being consistent and straightforward, like you would to any other normal person, call them out for problematic behaviors or for pissing you off, or
yeah, I think
that's super important to have both
yeah,
of them.
Yeah, the first one I call glad handers. Those are the ones where they're always super nice, and it'll all be okay. It'll all be okay. It won't all be okay. Some things aren't going to be okay until you work on it.
Yeah.
Everything will be okay if you focus on it and put effort towards it and work on it. But if you just say it's going to be okay, that's how we ended up with the last couple presidencies. Let's just not do this. So let's focus on what we can actually do and focus on what we can actually make better. And so but the other side, mm-hmm. in my opinion, the ones who are more harsh, they tend to fall in the camp that are trying to protect from self-indemnity. And that's where a lot of the school administrators and the ones who are trying to do that protection level, they're trying to protect against lawsuits and against their own liability, protect against their own thing. And the more they protect from their own liability, the more they depersonalize, dehumanize the thing that they're trying to protect against. Mm. That's it. We see it and it's a similar at that level. The dynamic is very similar between the threat in school and the thug on the street. Both are labels, both are useless, and both degenerate and degrade the person you're looking at and completely remove the ability to actually engage on a useful manner.
Yes.
That you have to see the person as the person and realize that at one time you were kind of like that. And adults tend to lose, the older we get and the more authority we get and the more power we assume, you tend to lose perspective on the fact that at one time you probably ate dirt. And that someone one time wiped your butt and changed your diaper. Like that happened to you. So you're not special. You're just old. That's one of the barriers that honestly I think will break down if people more talk about their pain. The more people, the most cathartic thing that happens is someone listens to me and then tells me their story. And then someone else listens to that and then tells their story. Mm-hmm. And the cascading amount of openness and removing of the stigma to talk about these kinds of things, to remove the harshness that people have that, well, we can't talk about depression. We can't talk about these. How are you? I still get that comment occasionally. Well, how could you even talk about that in public? You're saying you were almost a school shooter? Yeah, I do. Because somewhere, someone's going to listen to this and possibly be able to see the way out of that dark.
Yeah.
And if me talking can help even one person out of it, I'm never going to stop talking until I have no voice.
That's right. Yeah. And that's so beautiful too. Like the cascade of openness, and that I agree with you that like so much of this is centered on like the perception, a dehumanized perception of somebody, and whether you see them as a monster or a victim or a broken thing, you're dehumanizing them. You're not seeing them as a person. And just the way that when we do what you're describing right now, we all talk about our own pain, And we all remember that we were babies who pooped in our diapers, that we pooped this morning. Like, that is humanizing. That's leveling. Because along with the people who are prone to have dehumanizing perceptions of other people are also, I think, very prone to exalting people to above human status. So they do both things, right? They have this habit of seeing people on this sort of hierarchy of subhuman, transhuman, and then normal people. But that's all a delusion, in a sense, propped up by societal roles, no doubt, but it's truly delusional. Like, we are all equal in this sense, in terms of the worthiness of our existence.
Yep. And it's tied in with the fact that we all these days want to be the hero in our own story. We all think that we're the main character in the book. And so when we do that, we look at others and we turn them into characters. We'll turn them into, oh, that's the villain and that's the hero. And not realizing that everybody is a multifaceted individual. Mm-hmm. And it's important to point out that none of this is said to excuse or agree with the destructive attacks of these killers, like the mass shootings. In no way would I excuse or agree with at all the killings in Uvalde, or say that they were at all justified in any shape or fashion, because that's an important thing. People tend to, again, that absolutism that people have. Mm. They think that if you humanize someone, that means you're okay with it. Mm. No, it just means that I see the person that did it.
Yes.
The person that did it made an absolutely terrible, evil choice. And if he were alive, he should have faced the absolute worst punishment humanly possible, because he deserves the accountability for his actions. That's an important step with this, is accountability with it. But in the process of it, there's only a small sliver of people that will follow through with that attack. But there is a large gray area of people that think they should, could, or would. Mm. And those ones are the ones that we can absolutely reach before they hit that dark. That we can see and say, there's a light instead, and that that humaning, leveling, that helps on both sides. Not only does it help you see the person as a person, but then it helps them see you as a regular person too, and removes the assigned societal barriers. Because when you're in that depressive darkness, you think you're at the bottom, and that exalting you talk about, you do that with every other human that's not you. So that everybody else is better than you because you're the disgusting one, and being able to level out and say that, no, there isn't better or worse. There is different, but there isn't better or worse.
Yeah.
And I have seen that on such a massive scale. I've had the honor since coming out with my story of being reached out to by tens and tens of thousands of people from all over the planet. Mm. And from the kid in Detroit in the gangs to the kid in Pakistan who was getting abused so much and picked on that he couldn't talk about it because they were afraid he would kill him. That there wasn't any difference in the pain. That from Sri Lanka, Pakistan, Ireland, England, New Zealand, Canada, Mexico, there isn't any difference in the pain. There's difference in social status and from living situation. And it would look again like it would be vastly different. But at the heart of it, it's the same sense of self-loathing. I have the same conversations with the kid in Karachi as I do with the kid in Michigan. It's the same conversations. Mm. And to the point where I don't even tell where people are anymore, because it's literally the same. It's about being seen. It's about being heard and being acknowledged as a human. And if you're able to do that, if you're able to be that island in the ocean of chaos, if you're able to save that person in their mind by simply saying hello, then you will do the most transformative things ever. Because not only will you be that person's savior, but then you've got a friend, because that develops a bond that lasts forever. I have seen friendships develop out of those kind of situations that will last the test of time. Because when you save someone's existence by reminding them that they exist, then they will treat you in kind. And they'll pass that along, and they'll start to do the same for others. And it's that cascading positivity can possibly make a giant change. And you never know who you might talk to, who might be the next big one you change, who you might save next.
Right. gosh, it's just, it's so, it's encouraging. It's motivating to hear you talk about this. And I think it's important that it reminds every individual that they can be part of the solution. There are solutions that do need to be systemic, broad, perhaps policy related, but moreover, every individual can step up like today and acknowledge somebody and check in with somebody and just be, even on the, honestly, I really think, even if you don't know what to say, but you just check your perceptions, you check your perception and you dispute any perception of an individual as being less than human, mm-hmm. then that will give way to a bunch of feelings and behaviors that you don't necessarily have to script ahead of time, but those feelings and behaviors will be helpful. They will be helpful because they're coming from a place of seeing someone as a human being.
Mm-hmm. It's the difference between accusing and questioning. It's the difference between saying someone did this to me and saying, why did someone do this to me?
Mm. I also think it's important what you acknowledged about, you know, I see you feel the need to clarify that you definitely don't agree or condone any shootings. And I almost feel for you that you have to even explain that but I can see why you do. You know, people sometimes, I think people think that when you explain something, you excuse it, mm-hmm. but that's definitely not the same thing. You know, you can explain something.
I wouldn't excuse my own actions back in those days. I don't say that there was, I tell my story not to glorify and not to give any kind of celebrity. It's to illustrate that the reason why I came out with my story literally is the day after Parkland, I was watching the news with my family, and we were watching the news coverage of the Parkland massacre in Florida. And I watched a news reporter, and it was recording from the day of the attack. And she had walked up to a student leaving the school and asked, "How did you feel?" And to me, that was the most dehumanizing and depersonalizing thing and most angering thing I had ever seen. And it just angered me so much. And I went to the bathroom literally and sat down and wrote a post on Facebook about how I was almost a school shooter and about how we need to give love to the ones we feel deserve it the least. And it looks like it was a kid in pain. And that, but when I got done writing it, I walked out of the bathroom and my wife, who had only heard 60% of my history, and my oldest daughter, who only had heard maybe 20% of my history, we spent the rest of the night having a deep, tearful discussion about my life. Mm. And the next day, my wife was like, "Hey, they're talking about this all on the news. Our favorite newscaster here in Denver is this guy, Kyle Clark." And she was like, "Hey, you should maybe send your post to him on Twitter." Because over the night, my post on Facebook got like Facebook viral. It went like a couple tens of thousands of likes and shares. Like it went all around Facebook. And so she's like, "Hey, maybe you should send it to Kyle Clark." So I sent my Facebook post to him over Twitter. And the next day, there was a camera crew at my house to film me talking about it.
Wow.
And that video on that news channel got 17 million views in 2 days. And I instantly went from a guy sitting on my couch thinking that this was like I said, it was a millstone. I thought it was something that was just a weight that I would have to carry around forever, that it would just drag me down. If anybody knew about me, that would be a monster, that they would hate me. And I got immediately hit with thousands of messages from all over the planet, not only saying, it wasn't just, "Hey, thanks for telling your story." It was, "Hey, thanks for telling your story. And here's my diary. And here's everything that ever happened to me." And it was the most eye-opening and cathartic and life-changing experience I could have ever imagined.
Wow.
And it is not an honor I take lightly. Mm. And so it's not, if me talking at all can help one other person, people come to me occasionally and say, "Oh, you're brave for coming out about this." And I always bristle and am resistant to that because I am not brave. Being brave is acting in the face of change or acting in the face of fear. I am not acting in the face of fear. I have no fear of my life. This is just my life. This is the reality that I existed in. This is just me. You know, I always thought people would hate me if they knew it, and some do. So, you know, if you do, then okay. But I hated myself a lot longer than you did, so I'm sure I'll be all right.
Yeah.
And So but now if the ones who I think are really brave are the ones who message me and give me their life story and tell me everything that happened to them. And it's sometimes the first time they've ever told a human. Sometimes it's the deepest, darkest things that they make me promise I'll never reveal, but they tell me. And to me, that is bravery. That is acting in the face of fear. And so, yeah, never stop talking. If you talk about these things, someone else is going to listen and they're going to talk too. And the more we talk about it, the less we'll be afraid. The more you know about something, the less it can make you afraid and less it can hurt you.
Yes. How have you managed to communicate back with people? I imagine you've been inundated, especially after like that and then the TED Talk. And so how have you managed to communicate?
I'm a regular guy who works full time at a gas station.
Okay.
I just answer back.
Yeah.
I'm just a regular dude. I have a Facebook group called You Are Not Alone. It's all one word, each word is capitalized, You Are Not Alone. And it's okay. up to about 4,000 people now, I think. Right. And all over the planet. It's 166 countries. And there's just all over. And it's people all based around this depression, based around support. And it's all full of people looking for that support and actual therapists and counselors and police officers and people who have dealt with these things in real life. Mm-hmm. And it kind of gives a buffer zone for people to be able to talk about these things in a safe space where they can kind of vent without fear of trigger responses. Uh-huh. Because one of the most detrimental things about therapy can be that a therapist, if you reach out for help, it can actually destroy your world. And because if that therapist sees that something terrible is going on, like if let's say I was 13 years old and I reached out to social services and got them involved, they would come in, they would see what was happening, and then my mom would get arrested, and then she would go to jail, and then my family would go to jail, and everything would go to prison. Then my brothers would go to different, everybody would go to different houses. Like it would, my world would get blown up. So the fear, and that's supposed to be the help. The help blows the world up. So do I blow the world up and get potential help, or do I exist in the hell that I'm in and make it through? And so this gives them a space where they can kind of vent about that without fear of those trigger words that then make everybody immediately have to respond with police. And because I think I really, as needed as they are and as vital as it can be, where you have to have mandatory reporting, I totally understand the purpose of it. And I understand why it's a necessary thing. But I think that we have gotten so litigious with our language and so indemnified from personal responsibility that we have removed the ability for free expression of anger to be a thing. And when you have to restrict your emotional expression, then you might as well not be in therapy.
Mm-hmm. Strong analysis. Yeah. Well, I wanted to ask you that too. So, you know, along with that period where you really almost became a school shooter, I would imagine the story you just described to me of your childhood is, it's truly unbelievable. Like a tiny percentage of people experience such repeated extreme traumas. So my question to you is, what has your healing journey looked like for the past 20 years?
Well, it was, the biggest turning point was that time with the blueberry peach pie I talked with afterwards. That kind of set me off on a nice, good, positive path. Where I started to reassess my situation. And I was able to actually move in with Mike. So me and Mike moved in. The final break was that he moved out to Kansas City and got a job went to art school in Kansas City, and he moved me out there. And so I not only got to move out of state from my family, but moved in with Mike at the same time. So it was very positive at that point, because that's a whole different social environment. No degradation, none of that stuff at all. Just let me live with my best friend talking about stuff. And so that started a process that I call acknowledgement, which was to me the most cathartic thing of my recovery, which is where I went to the people that hurt me and stated what happened. One of my aunts, it started with that. She was at a bar. I was the bartender actually. And she's like, "Oh, you know, you love me." And I said, "No, I don't." She says, "Oh, you know, you love me." And I said, "No, really, I don't love you. you tried to kill yourself on my front lawn, and you're a massive alcoholic who tried to molest me. So I do not love you. I'm sorry. And that started a process where I went to the people that hurt me and told them what happened. Mm. And it had nothing to do with their response. It had nothing to do with whether or not they were upset or whether or not they were yelling. I didn't care what their response was. It had to do with me getting it off of my chest. Yeah. I had to release it from myself. So that was a very important and cathartic process. So when I did that, that took a couple years to finally go through with that. And then I had my first kid, and that really gave me something to lose. And that changed my perspective. And then I really started on working towards myself. But honestly, I didn't ever think it was a positive until I came out with my story. It was still a depressive element until 4 or 5 years ago when I first started talking about it. Mm. And then the catharsis from coming out about it and being able to hundreds of times now fully examine and go through the details of the story with various interviewers and people and stories and TED Talks. And like, I've been able to do a kind of immersion therapy in a way where dove headlong into my depression and examined all the nooks and crannies. Mm. And so nowadays, I am quite proud of who I am because I am a father of four, and my children are my best friends. And my 21-year-old daughter is one of my best friends in the world. And she's the one that says my life seems like a Stephen King movie. And I tell my kids I love them so much, it's annoying. Like every conversation I say I love them. Every single time I talk to them, I say I love them. And then I literally tell them I use my own parents as examples for what to do for parenting. I follow my parenting style based on my parents. I just do the reverse.
Right.
I do the opposite of what happened to me. So whatever they did, I just change it around. Mm. So I go to all their games. I go to all their shows. I go to all their performances. I talk to all their teachers. I let their friends come over and have sleepovers. In fact, I got one upstairs right now. We are the safe, happy family house where people can come over and hang out all the time. And never once have my kids had to deal with a parent hitting another parent.
Mm.
And so I won.
Yes, you did. Yes, you did. How fortunate they are to have you as a father. And one of
I'm fortunate to have them as kids. They're pretty damn good kids, that I have to say. I lucked out as a dad.
Awesome. One of the things that I can't help but think about being, I would consider myself a student of the guy named Viktor Frankl. Are you familiar with Viktor? Yeah.
I am. Yep. So, I've read it.
Okay. So you too, then you know his work, and you know his emphasis on meaning in life and the emphasis on finding meaning specifically in our suffering, in our hardship. And just to me, you know, your life, your story is such a shining example of you. I mean, you could either use the word finding or creating meaning in our suffering. And it's like you, in other words, you made it so that your suffering was not in vain. Mm-hmm. And that now, especially at this point, it is actually something that means so much to the world because it has produced a human being with tremendous insight and who's incredibly inspiring and who is initiating that cascade of opening up and talking about pain. And honestly, to me, it even holds more weight that you're a man and you look like a manly man. You know what I mean? Like there's something about that too, that I actually think makes your process of sharing the story with the world even more powerful.
I think that men need to get more in touch with their emotions a lot. Like I never did. When I was a teenager, when I was growing up, I was the angry one. I was the mosh pit when I went to concerts. Like I would go to a mosh pit and knock the whole thing over. I Slipknot, Nine Inch Nails. That was my world back then. And so now I cry at the stupidest movies. Like I will sit and watch a Disney movie and just bawl like a baby. And my wife was like, "Are you really crying at that show?" I'm like, "Yeah, in fact, I am." I think the biggest thing for me was that after a lifetime of hating myself, I think I beat out the ability in myself to get embarrassed. Mm. That anybody that ever came up to me, they had, if they had a fat joke, I had 10 fat jokes better than you did. Mm-hmm. And I could make fun of myself way better than anybody else ever could. Mm-hmm. And so nowadays, I just don't have it in me. And to couple with that, I also did a physical transformation at the same time, where right about at the same time I did my TED Talk, I also lost about 250 pounds.
Oh.
So I went from a high of about 470 to today, I'm about 260.
Damn, Aaron, that's very inspiring and impressive. Wow.
Yeah, and literally during my TED Talk, on stage of my TED Talk, under my shirt, I had bandages from my weight loss surgery. So It was at the same time, same month, okay. I was doing everything. Wow. I'm literally a different person now. Like a weight has theoretically and literally been lifted.
Right.
And it's given me a new lease on everything. And like I said, if I can keep on talking and help even one person, then I'm going to keep on talking. At the beginning of August, I'm actually going to be speaking to a convention of school administrators in the Uvalde School District.
Oh, wow.
On August 4th at the San Antonio Botanical Gardens, I'm going to be presenting to the entire school district there with Uvalde and the surrounding administrators. And I'm going to be the final speech of the afternoon and then be I'm going to be greeting with everybody afterwards. So be talking and having dinner. And so that's the principals and administrators and all the school staff from Uvalde. So it's going to be intense.
Yeah. Yeah. You're the man for the job. That's just, again, like I said,
it's an honor I don't take lightly. It's definitely humbling to think that it's weird in a lot of ways. Like, I had to get therapy at the beginning of it to just adjust to the fact that people want to film me talking about me in high school. Mm-hmm. Like, that was a weird fact in and of itself. Like, cause you sit around with your buddies and you reminisce about what the high school day is, and no one ever thinks about, hey, I want to put that on TV. Right. And so like, it's a bit strange, but if I can help even one person, I'm just going to keep on going. So.
Well, thank you for bringing it to this platform. It's an honor that I don't take lightly to have you. And I can tell, you know, that you're generous with your time and that you're eager to share. And I just think, again, it's incalculable the positive impact you are already having, and when all is said and done, that you will have had on the world. I mean, just so inspiring. I mean, incalculable and kind of like infinite, you know, the positive chain reaction of all these opportunities you're giving people to listen to you and understand you, and the insight you're offering. It's just, it will ripple into the future forever. So
I'm just a regular guy. And to me, it's important to remember that as outlandish as my story might seem, and as much of a unicorn as I might appear, I'm actually much more like a squirrel. I am much more like a squirrel than a unicorn, in the sense that I am everywhere and unseen. That all over the place, there are me's. There are me's all in every city, in every town. There are me's right down the street from you. There are me's probably next door to you. And my goal is to stop the next me from becoming the monster that I thought I was.
Right.
And if we can show those people that they matter, that they can exist in the pain, even when it's intense, that they can make it through it, that there's a life to enjoy afterwards, that it's just a Tuesday, then maybe we can stop the next one.
Well, Aaron, let's stay connected.
Of course.
Yeah. I trust we'll talk again. We'll reconnect. But thank you from the bottom of my heart for your time today.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it. And thank you for everybody listening. And remember, just give love to the ones you feel deserve it the least. You are not alone.